It's my great pleasure to welcome Federico to IDEAS and to the Latin America program, and we look forward to hearing what you've got to say.
Thank you. Thank you, Tanya. Thank you, everybody, for coming here this afternoon. First of all, the title of the presentation is a bit misleading, because if you have the opportunity of reading at least the title of my paper, there are some changes. Actually, my paper is broader than the title of this presentation. So that's a clarification. I want to thank to the IDEAS, particularly to Arnie, who was the factotum of my visit here to London, and you, Tanya, and George. Where is George? Yeah. who made the extra mile for my visit here to London. What I'm going to do is to skip a bit the theoretical surrounding my paper and the English code. I will assume, maybe wrongly, that all of you know the basic of the English code. Coming from Buenos Aires to London to talk about the English code, you know, sound kind of, I feel like Elizabeth Taylor's late husband, you know, who has no clue what to do to cheer her up. So that's why I'm going to skip a bit that debate and we'll go to the bones of the Latin American International Society. But beforehand, I want to say something about the English code. Those people that teach English code or write about the English code in introductory chapters, in handbooks, in textbooks, they usually make several moves, several theoretical moves. The first one is to say that English code is not a theory. Is a broader perspective, an intellectual tradition, is a faith rather than a closed church, right? And a fundamental problematic of this perspective is the normative dialogue among states. That's the focus of the English code. The second general move is that the explanation power of this tradition lies in the very idea that IR cannot be grasped by a single logic, but by the interconnection between three arenas: the material-based political pressures, the normative arrangements, and the transnational flows. This is what the triad of the English code is all about, yeah? The international system, the international society, and the world society, populated by non-state actors. The third move is, well, after praising the power of this triad, however, the analysis generally turns to focus on the dimension of international society and its constitutive social institutions, like war, balance of power, diplomacy, or international law. What I think is that the improvement in the study of international society came with a price, which was neglecting, actually, the material side of the school and the non-state actors that surround the international global society. The fourth move, the recent move, is a critique of the Eurocentric perspective of the English school. You know, Hedrick Bull, Adam Watson were more concerned about the expansion of a European-based international society. That's why regions were not important per se, but in how they were absorbed by the European-based international society. Two ideas follow from this critique. First, there is no single story to tell, and so the idea of an international system working evenly under the same patterns should be discussed. Second, a decentralized approach opens up the perspective to look at regions beyond a developed core as places in which particular patterns of international relations take place. This opens up the possibility to compare regions in terms of how they organize their dialogue among states. So far, so good. But the regional turn, for me, makes apparent the need to put the triad back on work. Mainly because in developing societies, geographic position, economic conditions, interaction capabilities, state infrastructure, and domestic political patterns seems to highly influence the way international relations work. And all these issues has been mainly neglected by the English school. And so this is the case of Latin America. So my argument here today is that the study of Latin America as a regional society makes the case for considering the full tool case of the English school, the material side, the normative arrangements, and the non-state actors. What I'm going to do is for to present my findings related to the institution of international society in Latin America, and then to revisit them from a more systemic and war society perspective to prove my point. Let's start with war as the foundational problematic in IR. You know, in Latin America, we had three cycles of war. Independence War, the first one. Independence War, they were at the same time international against Spain and Brazil, but also civil wars against Americans and American Spaniards living in America. Then we have interstate war, which were driven mainly by search of territory and natural resources. And then we have civil wars, which were about organizing principles, liberals, nationalists, federalists, unitarians, etc. The Count of Miguel Ángel Centeno compares interstate wars and civil wars in Latin America. In the two centuries in Latin America, we have had 15 interstate wars versus 65 civil wars. So war became less and less common as we turn to the 20th century. The last war in South America was about 80 years ago, when Bolivia and Paraguay, two of the maybe the weakest states in South America, went to the Chaco War, 1933, if I'm not wrong. So two discussions follow from this observation. The first one is the relation between war making and state building, and how this relation was very much different to the European Union. This is the thesis of Miguel Ángel Centeno, Benjamin Miller as well, has a very interesting chapter on Latin American international society. The second discussion is about the theories to explain why war stopped being a way to solve conflicts in the region. Last war, I said before, was in the 30s between Bolivia and Paraguay. So some refers to an anomaly. There is an anomaly in the region. Latin America is an anomaly compared to other regions. This is what realist and liberal says, for instance. Other refers to Latin America as a zone of peace, a zone of peace, in which the way to solve conflicts was a juridical way, the juridical resolution of conflicts. Others said, well, don't be too optimistic. We have no war, but we are a violent region. So let's talk about a violent peace. A violent peace, which means the militarization of disputes. Since the 90s, according to the counting of David Maris, since the 90s, we have had 70 militarized conflicts, but only when, all of them related to territorial discussions, to territory and resources. And only one went into warlike violence between Peru and Ecuador in the beginning of the 90s. All of them, I said, related to territorial conflicts. So what this shows is Latin American normative arrangements pose a very high cost for going to war, but a very low cost to militarize territorial conflicts. They have leaders in Latin America have a lot of incentives to militarize territorial discussions. I will refer to this later on. So Latin America, in terms of war, is somewhere in between a no-war zone and a security community. We have no wars, but we still are far from the European Union, this Kantian scenario. What happened with balance of power? The other institution put forward by Hedley, Bula, and other members of the English group. Latin America witnessed balance of power dynamics in the 19th century, and it is very easy to find realist explanations of these patterns. What we have, may I make a draw?
Yeah.
The 19th century established the basic pattern of balance of power, at least I will refer to South America, in which we have Argentina and Brazil on the one hand, we have a perpendicular dilemma of security. And then we have Chile plus Bolivia plus Peru, with the other perpendicular logic of security dilemma. But then we have kind of horizontal cooperation logics between Brazil and Chile on the one hand, and between Argentina and Bolivia and Peru on the other hand, for obvious reasons. If we add Ecuador here, what we have is a logic of cooperation between Chile and Ecuador, because Ecuador was always confronted to Peru. So this is the basic pattern. But as we move to the 20th century, this is not enough to explain dynamics in the region, because here we have more friendly relationship, and here as well.
So, and I think that this dynamic started to change in the 50s, in the 60s, when cooperation on the economic and political sectors started to make relations more complex. Democratization in the 80s reinforced this trend. So what kind of power dynamic do we have today in Latin America? If we look to South America, we will discover that Brazil represents 50% of its territory, 50% of its population, 50% of the GDP, of the regional GDP, and, more important, 50% of the military spending in South America. So the power asymmetry is very important in South America. But the question is, who is balancing Brazil? Who is afraid of Brazil's hegemonic aspirations? Actually, is Brazil able and willing to project power in a classic realist fashion? My answer is no. Brazil is a power, but it's not a leader, nor it has loyal followers around it. It has neither the military power to provoke fear, nor the economic power to be generous. Brazil's leadership has been mainly an intellectual leadership, putting forward ideas on how to cooperate and engage the rest of the countries in that project. So what you have in Latin America is what Richard Little, a very well-known member of the English school, calls an associative or cooperative balance of power. What this means, basically, that the region has not transcended power. Power is in the mind of the state leaders, but they deal with it through other strategies than balancing, such as concert, presidential diplomacy, and international law. Let us turn to these two institutions, international law and diplomacy. I opted to analyze them together because my point here is that in Latin America, diplomatic and juridical discourses are intertwined in a way that political conflicts are legally processed and legal conflicts are politically agreed by last-minute presidential diplomacy. That's why I use the metaphor of the ribbon belt. Do you know the ribbon belt? It's a belt that before you meet the ends, you twist it. So you start on the outside, and suddenly you are on the inside of the belt. There is no outside and inside. So you start via diplomacy and end up in international law and the other round as well. And what we have in Latin America in terms of diplomacy and international law, which for me are the basic and the most important institutions in this regional society, is a very strong core of normative dialogue, first established via the Pan-American conferences, then via the creation of the Organization of the American States. For different reasons that has to do with power politics, international law has been, from the beginning, an identity builder in the region to assure interstate subjectivities. Some facts are known, but it would be good to bring them up here today. Utis possidetis is a legal term in international law that means something like, as you possess, you may possess. disputis possidetis, can be considered the first intersubjective idea that Latin America developed as a regional society. Just at the very beginning of the independence process, they organized the territory along the principle of utis possidetis. In 200 years of independent states in Latin America, no state has disappeared. Only one, Panama, was born out of Colombia in 1903, and for reason that has to do with the U.S. Latin America is the region with the highest number of treaties related to peaceful conflict resolution. Latin America was the first region to be free of nuclear weapons in 1967. Latin America has no split Koreas, no refugee camps, no dividing walls, no suicide bombers, no no-fly zones, no strong us and them international dynamics, no irredentist claims, no genocides. Since the 80s, Latin America moved beyond pluralist conceptions of international society and added up democracy and human rights into this normative dialogue. And yet we still lack a clear roadmap on how to act in cases of violation of these principles. What happened recently in Honduras and what is going on in Venezuela reflect this tension between normative arrangements and a diplomatic situation that works against enforcing democracy and human rights. So normative arrangements have gone further than diplomatic and political arrangements in Latin America. What we have thus is a pluralist international society based on non-intervention, juridical equality, uti possidetis, peaceful resolution of conflicts, with some solidarist niches, but we are still very far from embarking in a trip that takes us beyond Westphalia. Let's turn to the market. The market as an institution was actually never studied in the English school. What I say in my paper is it is very important to study the market, in this case the regional market, as a regional institution, and it has to do with the development topics that for me are more important than the war and peace issues in Latin America. Said in another way, development has been in Latin America high politics, and sometimes war and peace were actually low politics in our region. But the Latin American regional market is a quite new institution. It's a 20th century institution. Latin American countries were, from the beginning, were much more connected to their northern partners than among themselves. Today, even today, we don't have a single train connecting two countries in South America. Not a single train. Only after the Second World War, Latin America started to think at the regional level and how to integrate national markets in a regional way, how to gain economic scale. And since then, we have had kind of three rounds of regional integration. The first one, during the 50s, conceived in the context of the ISI, which was the industrialization by import substitution. The second one, during the 90s, written in the context of the neoliberal Washington consensus. And the third round, the current one, which is being thought in the context of post-liberal agendas, anti-Americanism and state-based nationalism. Evo Morales' statement in a recent interview is very illustrative. He said that UNASUR, you know, is kind of combination of Mercosur and the Andean community of nations. UNASUR, he said, is the organization in which Latin Americans can solve our problems only among us. UNASUR is to get rid of the empire. That was the aim of UNASUR, which is very different to the aims followed by Mercosur or by CAN during the 90s. Even they were different rounds with very different logics, the pattern was similar. The three rounds were promoted and implemented by the states. in a very intergovernmental setting. The three rounds combined demanding rules with a very high dose of pragmatism. Civil society and the private sector were more defensive than offensive players in the regional integration process. So at the end of the day, integration ended up strengthening sovereignty rather than pulling it upwards towards transnational agencies. The general idea at the end of the day has been to achieve at the regional level what we has not been possible at the national level: autonomy, influence, and economic scales. So this is my general structure of these international institutions. What happened when we bring back system and world society? The picture gets very much more complex. I will not get into a detailed analysis of each of these institutions from system and non-state actors. I just want to put forward several observations which I think are crucial to understand that the shape of this international institution I already talked about are related to systemic factors, subnational settings, and transnational patterns. Three things that get lost when we approach a region only through the lens of international society. I repeat, systemic factors, subnational settings, and transnational patterns. First, let us start with the systemic factors. I have in mind at least three systemic factors, which for me are very crucial to understand. The first one is the cohabitation with the U.S., living very close to the U.S. No one has that privilege. America became unipolar much, when I say America, I say the whole continent, right? America became unipolar much more before the rest of the world did it by the end of the 20th century. Fear of U.S. imperialism and intervention in domestic affairs explains many things in the Latin American regional society. For instance, a strong pluralist international society based on the principles of non-intervention and peaceful conflict resolution. But the U.S. also explained why many countries in Latin America find it difficult to integrate themselves. Trade flows are much more connected with the U.S. than with their neighbors. Even Hugo Chavez is one of the main trade partners of the U.S. in Latin America. 90% of his oil goes directly to the U.S., to his main enemy, the devil, as he said in the UN General Assembly. The second systemic factor, the location of Latin America in the periphery of the capitalist system. This has had very important implications, particularly when it comes to development. Well, I don't want to get into the discussion of the dependencia school, which I'm sure you already know. I just want to highlight the gap here between ideological preferences socially constructed among the states in the region and the material incentives objectively established through trade structure and flows. Said otherwise, there is a gap in the region between society-driven intentions to integrate and system-driven actions. Just a few data. Peru's exportation to Switzerland are higher than its total exportation to the whole Andean region. Brazil's main trade partner is not Argentina, it's China. Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia export much more to the U.S. than among them. Chile plays its own game and has an evenly distributed trade between Latin America, the U.S., Europe, and Asia. So the question is, who is demanding more regional integration when the private sector is filling its pockets with money coming from other corners? The third systemic factor has to do with the kind of unit we have in Latin America. And when I say unit, I'm thinking in the state. What kind of state we have in Latin America? I'm not a political scientist. I will not go into any detailed observation of the kind of state we have. But I want to refer basically to the fact that Latin American countries are infrastructurally weak countries with a very low control of their territories. They have been very unstable politically, facing civil wars, military coup, and civilian revolts. Furthermore, they are also very polarized countries in terms of the Gini index, and this fact paved the way to ideologically polarized societies as well. I think these facts explain many things. We have more geography than sovereignty. We have more territory than state, and we have more people than citizens. In terms of wars, political leaders have been more preoccupied with the enemy within than with the enemy at the border. Much more people have died from local bullets than from international ones. In terms of power, state leaders have been preoccupied with balancing foreign regional powers, but have been much more concerned about balancing internal factors. They were afraid of coups rather than of wars. Weak political system also explained the development of international law. State leaders have used international law not because of a moral grandeur, but in order to tie down their survival to regional regimes. There are many examples in Latin America of juridical doctrines aiming at not recognizing leaders that arrive to power without democratic procedures. So let us turn to the non-state actors to see that picture gets even more complex. I have three things to say, and they run in very different directions. The first one, I think that one of the most sustained and common discourse in regional diplomacy is the idea that Latin America conforms a patria grande, a big fatherland, a big nation split into 22 republics that speak only two languages, pray in a massive way to just one God, and has a very similar ethnic origin and historical background. Think of a person that could walk from Madrid to Beijing without having to change the language. That is impossible, but it's very possible in Latin America. The distance from Ushuaia in the south of Argentina to Tijuana in the north of Mexico, you could go all the way up speaking just Spanish. I think that this discourse helps to explain many things as well, from peaceful conflict resolution to sentimental players to regional integration. The second thing I want to raise here is about political identities. I think that domestic political identities related to ideologies, to party fractions, to moved social movements, have been a very influencing factor in shaping international relations and foreign policy in the region. State leaders have tended, in Latin America, to create an ideologically homogeneous society, regional society, as a way either to align with the US or to gain autonomy from it, but also have worked in this way in order to assure their survival. Put it another way, a weak neighboring state that is of a distinct different ideological character is more threatening than a strong neighboring state of the same political ideology. Therefore, when Hugo Chavez wishes to expand his model to the rest of the region, he does not do so by imperial design, but as a way of ensuring that his regional surrounding contribute to his own survival. The last dimension I want to raise is the dark side of the non-state actors. The dark side has to do with what Barry Boussan refers to the uncivil society. And that is a very hot spot today in Latin America. It represents the most important threat to national and human security. We may have no wars, but we have a lot of violence. We may have no nuclear weapons, but we do have tons of small arms. We may not have ethnic wars, but we do have a drug war in Colombia and in Mexico. We may have no genocides, but we have a lot of human trafficking. According to the UNDP, homicides in Latin America reach 25 for every 100,000 inhabitants, which is the highest level on Earth and three times the general average. For the last two decades, violence has been the principal cause of death among Latin Americans between 15 and 44 years old. Only in Mexico, in the last 4 years, 30,000 people have died because of drug-related violence. 30,000 people in 4 years. According to the World Drug Report, the Andean region houses 90% of the world production of coca leaf and cocaine. 90%. Drugs in Latin America, besides the legal factor, is a multi-million dollar business which involves all sorts of different public and private actors and different levels of action, from municipalities to regions. And so the ability that it has demonstrated to impinge on entire cities is enormous, corrupting political leaders, money laundering, buying private security, engaging the young people in the business, buying arms, and of course, eroding democratic institutions. So I want to conclude. I will skip theoretical conclusions and finish commenting on Latin America. As we have seen, Latin America is a region that presents unique patterns of international relations. These patterns have to do with the way Latin America states have adopted normative arrangements, but they also have to do with the place Latin America occupies in the world, below the US, far from world powers, and at the margins of capitalism, and also have to do with the Latin American culture or identity, which feel is still far from reaching its destiny of integration. So Latin America is an arena that contains much more than the realists would allow for, but much less than the liberals do. There exists a negative peace defined as the absence of war, but not a positive one as defined by the presence of material and social conditions that point toward a lasting peace. There is economic integration between states, but there is no economic governance beyond state. The power dynamics are not as the realists would claim them to be, but the region has yet to reach the stage of forming a security community. It has adopted rising international standards on democracy and on human rights, but has failed to consider how to enforce them. Not much more, but not much less.
Thank you very much. We have about 20 minutes for questions, comments from you all. So I'd like to open up to the floor and give you all the opportunity to respond or ask any questions.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here to comment on Federico's paper. Well, one of the problems of the English school is precisely that it is not a theory, that it is an intellectual program, and that therefore it is difficult to go and to see what is exactly the relative weight of the different components of the program. I think that one of the key issues that realists will come back to always when looking at the English school program is what exactly is the relationship between those normative arrangements that you're talking about and state behavior. Yeah? I mean, whether those normative arrangements are the ones that are actually affecting state behavior, or whether it isn't just whether maybe the systemic components that you talked about are maybe enough to explain why states behave the way they behave. And I think that in order to sort out that question, we need to go back to history, and we need to carry out a lot of historiographical work, and in each case to analyze whether those normative arrangements are actually affecting state behavior in each case. Yeah? And that requires a lot of historical scholarship on every instance. Yeah? You have to go back to the meat of the issue, you have to go back to the case studies, and see whether actually norms have really driven the behavior of Latin American states in every historical instance. Yeah. So that is you know, that's one of the issues there it's just a simple point. Then there are things that I would dispute in your paper. Yeah? For example, the assertion that in 200 years no state has disappeared other than Panama. I think that the wars of independence in Latin America were full of the emergence of microstates. You mentioned Texas, for example. Yeah, Texas was a state at one point. It disappeared. Yeah? Argentina itself was a myriad of different states, all of which had state capabilities, and they disappeared. I'm not looking here at the historical detail, but actually at the theoretical lesson, which is that maybe the 19th century was a much more violent system than the one you sort of portray in your paper.
The 19th century?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
I know that you paint the picture there, a comparison between the 19th century and the 20th century, but I think that has to be sort of mentioned. For example, the Central American Federation was a state after all.
Do you want to respond to those first?
Yes, or maybe I can collect a bunch of questions.
Yeah, well, if there are other questions to collect.
If there is any.
Okay, Thomas first, and then.
Well, mine's real quick. You mentioned about...
Now that you are a doctor, you can talk.
Now I can say whatever. I'm going to attack. I had a question about the railroads. You said that there's no railroads between the connected Latin American countries. I guess, did you mean no railroads between two Latin American capitals? Because there are definitely railroads that cross borders.
But there's no trains that go on them since the mid-90s. For example, if you look at the Bolivia-Argentina track, you can take the train to the border in Villazón. Then you have to cross it walking, because there's no train that goes from Buenos Aires to Jujuy.
Oh, really?
So there's a train track.
Bus after that. Yeah.
There's a train track, but you can't actually go on it. So.
Okay. Well, I know people that take the trip, but I didn't really get off the train.
Francisco.
And it's more about small, short trips, between just in the border, not connecting massive.
You mentioned one of the characteristics of Latin American reduction or integration, the prevalence of presidentialist diplomacy. I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more about the strengths and weaknesses of why so much presidentialist diplomacy, and what are the main problems of that.
Okay.
And one last question.
On a more current state of affairs, Brazil has changed its president and nominated Mr. Patriota as Minister of Foreign Affairs. One of the first things that Mr. Patriota did was visit Uruguay and arrange a meeting with Argentina with a clear message to the region. Do you see a change in Brazil's attitude, as you mentioned, not as a leader, but more as a sort of... in basketball would be like a pivot, or someone that's constantly arranging things but not really leading the way in Latin America. Do you see that this sign of Brazil more serious attitude towards the region, or do you reckon that Brazil would follow the path dependence or the path that already has followed before?
Collect a few more. Yes, exactly.
Martin, I agree with you. You mentioned the independence process. I mean, of course, at the beginning, nothing was said that Argentina was going to be a country like the one we have, right? It wasn't written anywhere. What I referred to was once the process of independence ended up, and we have the established interstate system by the 22-23, right? No state disappeared in Latin America.
The Central American Republic was after that, yes?
Yes, it lasted a couple of years. And then Colombia split into Venezuela, Ecuador, and so on. So, I mean, from the 30s onwards, we didn't have a Czechoslovakia, you know, a Yugoslavia. Sudan today, which is being split. The question of the norm, yes. The way of, you know, systemic pressures or normative arrangements. I think it should be an empirical study to reach. It takes an empirical study to realize that. Ari Kakovic has done a pretty good job in his book on the normative impacts, the impacts of norms in international relations in the Latin American case. And sometimes, yes, he says that systemic pressures are also important. It has to do with how, to what extent normative arrangements are internalized within the country and within the domestic arrangement. Presidential diplomacy. I think that presidential diplomacy is the external face of a domestic one, which is very strong presidentialist political system in Latin America. And I think that presidential diplomacy comes with pros and cons. On the one hand, presidential diplomacy can solve problems very quickly with just an embrace, brotherhood, the Latin American brotherhood and the Patria Grande, you know, let's solve the problems. What Brazilians refers to the Jeitinho, right? On the other hand, presidential diplomacy, I don't think is good for a long-term institutionalized foreign policy, because one president can say and do one thing, and the next president can change everything and start from anew. And this is a very common pattern, at least in Argentina. Every time we have a new president, that president, at least from Alfonsín onwards, every president say two things. One, I want to rebuild the country. Reconstruir la patria. Vengo a reconstruir la patria. The other is the previous government. And the other thing, which is the external dimension, is I will reinsert the country in the international system. Because it was badly inserted before. So I want to take the country from where it was and put it back again where it should be. At the end of the day, we don't have that kind of 180 degrees change. But I think that is bad for a kind of long-term institutional foreign policy. And the question regarding Brazil's attitude to the region, well, I think it's too soon to tell about Dilma Rousseff's foreign policy. My hunch is that she will rely on South America at the beginning in a very strong way, up to 1 year, 1 year and a half. I mean, they cannot sign it, yeah, right? But once she gets confident about her position as president and start to catch up via Itamaraty how the world works, she will project power again as Lula has been doing in the last 8 years. I think at the beginning every new Brazilian president starts saying Latin America, South America, and particularly Argentina, right? Or the Southern Cone. But then, as soon as they start gaining confidence and they know about, you know, the international agenda, which is very complex, they will start to... Dilma Rousseff, I think she will continue basically with the foreign policy pattern that Lula established. And this has three corners. One corner is South America, in which Brazil wants to gain a critical mass of support in order to project its foreign power beyond the region.
right?
That's one corner. The other corner is the BRICS, China, Russia, and India. And this created the idea of South-South cooperation, or a way to enhance, to improve, to empower the global South. Mm-hmm. But Brazil is not only doing that. The other thing Brazil is doing is engaging the North in a very constructive way. So it's part of the G8 plus, it's part of the G20. So Brazil, a Brazilian diplomat travels to the North, he says, I'm representing the South, and I can be a kind of bridge between the North and the South. When Brazilian diplomats travel to South America or to Asia, they say, okay, let's gain power, let's, you know, make joint programs in order to put forward reforms and demands to the international system, basically to the northern countries. So they play both sides. The scholars say that Brazil suffers from a conflict identity between being the less developed country among the richest one, or the richest country among the less developed countries. You have the both sides of the same coin.
Thank you. We've got about 5 minutes for a few more questions, so we'll take a couple.
I wanted to ask you a question about UNASUR and what do you think of the future of it as an institution. Do you think it will manage to integrate the trade, the regional trade organizations like the CAN and Mercosur? Or as we're seeing already, Mercosur, Venezuela's entry is stalled by Paraguay, Colombia wants to get into Mercosur, they're not channeling it through UNASUR. And related to that, what do you think would be the implications of choosing the Venezuelan over the Colombian candidate or vice versa for Secretary General of UNASUR? If you think there are any implications of that.
Very, very good question. So,
okay, we'll take a couple.
More an observation than a question. When you mentioned that most of the trade among Latin American countries is outside of the region than amongst each other. The usual comparison is the EU, but if you look at other regional integration projects, you observe similar phenomena like the Gulf Cooperation Council, so obviously they export petroleum and energy not to each other, but outside, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which do a lot of processing, assembling trade, so they don't sell amongst each other, but outside as well, or even the Caribbean Community. You observe similar phenomena.
Exactly.
It's more of the rule than the exception in regional integration.
Exactly.
Projects.
Yes. I mean, this is a discussion more with the Europeans, you know, that they think that they can reproduce the European model everywhere. And I don't agree with that. I think that Europe is more an exception than the rule. I agree with you, absolutely.
Keep going.
The UNASUR question, I think, is very interesting. It's one of the most interesting topics in the regions right now, the evolution of regional integration. I think that UNASUR is not about trade at all. Nobody is talking about free trade today in South America. Maybe with the exception of Colombia, Chile, Peru, but they are not looking at UNASUR in terms of free trade. They do their own business outside UNASUR, right? With the US, with the European Union, with China, and a lot of different countries. But UNASUR is not about trade. So the question is, what is UNASUR about? I think that UNASUR is about creating a political concert among South American countries in order to smooth conflicts in order to put forward common proposal on the political sector and on the economic sector, but not related to trade, but to interaction capabilities, energy, communication, infrastructure, hydroelectric, for instance, represas, dams. Yeah, dams, and that kind of things. And as well on security and defense, you have the South American Defense Council, know? It is a kind of paradox that in South America it is easier to cooperate on security and defense issues than on trade issues. You know, trade is high politics sometimes in South America. So, and the good point of UNASUR is that if you see the UNASUR short trajectory, you have that UNASUR showed up when the Colombia crisis of the with Ecuador, when Colombia entered Ecuadorian territory, when Colombia signed an agreement with the U.S. to use Colombian military bases, when Evo Morales' situation was under risk, kind of revolts and try attempts to remove him, when the earthquake on Haiti, when the earthquake took place in Chile, when I there is something more in between. Never mind.
Correa.
Ah, Correa. The coup attempt. I don't know if there was an attempt of coup, but something was going on there, and Correa called UNASUR and Néstor Kirchner, you know, called the UNASUR to meet up and discuss the issue. So what you have there is a similar pattern, which is UNASUR is very well to avoid public bots, but it's not good to build in public goods. No. UNASUR is there to avoid the system breakdown. But so far, we don't have a UNASUR with positive proposal, with constructive proposal. It's more a defensive forum than an offensive one. When I say offensive, I'm not saying military offensive. I'm saying positive proposal, positive projects. Right?
We had one last question. Yeah, I can take a couple more if you'd like.
I'm just building on a couple of earlier comments. In answer to that question about whether it's norms or systemic pressures that are doing the work, you cited Larry Kaplowitz's book. One of the most interesting things about the Kaplowitz is that he starts in 1881. And he starts in 1881 because of quite a serious misreading of Henley Bull. He doesn't realize that Bull really does regard war as being an institution of international society. He can't quite believe that.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting in the Latin American context because, again, in the little exchange about when does the state system settle down, I thought it quite interesting considering where you come from, Buenos Aires, that it didn't get named. You know, I mean, it was virtually, we have to wait till 1862, but not the Mitre.
Yes.
The Argentine state
yes,
in yes. War. So the interesting thing that's neglected, and I think would be a very interesting empirical area to explore further, is how norms develop, and it would require this very sort of careful empirical work, how norms for the use of violence develop in the 19th century between independence and this late 19th century consolidation, how it is that those norms break down in the classic case of the War of the Triple Alliance. Once they're established,
I don't have the answers, I'm sorry. What I can say from the Triple Alliance War against, you know, Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay fought against Paraguay. Today it seems a very, very unfair war, but by that time I mean, nobody considered it that way. Actually, Paraguay was, you know, kind of seen like a threat, because it was becoming industrialized, and Bartolomé Mitre, the Argentine president by that time, he referred to the Triple Alliance War as the last civil war in Argentina.
So the question then is why the levels.
He didn't consider the
very, very low.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the northern province of Argentina actually allied with Solano López in Paraguay. The people from Corrientes is one of the oldest provinces in Argentina. They say, look, if it is about killing Porteños, count on me. About killing Paraguayans, go another place.